Yourself.
What?
What have you done to this country?
You're right to me.
What?
Absolute you're right to me.
It's a weird atmosphere to know that people have voted against having you here as a person.
Mr. Speaker, the British people have voted to leave the European Union. It was not the result I wanted, nor the outcome that I believe is best.
After decades of uneasy relations with Europe, Britain has finally chosen to take back control.
I think it's a wrong decision, but there you go, that's democracy for you.
We followed the twists and turns of this bitter breakup since the referendum to understand the reason why the British people turned away from the EU.
Europe is like a big monster.
This was the opportunity to kick the government, to kick the establishment.
The political storm that followed.
I saw on a television monitor at my feet that the Prime Minister had just resigned.
You lose a Prime Minister, you lose a Chancellor of the Exchequer, and people think, well, the whole country's sort of falling apart.
And the major consequences that have already emerged across the United Kingdom.
I think it's very difficult to run this country without immigration.
Some people believe it is open season now for racism and xenophobia.
I mean, saying I told you so doesn't help anybody.
There's a big social division in our society.
The Article 50 process is now underway.
There is no reason to pretend that this is a happy day.
It is tempting to think that Brexit was just about Britain parting ways with Europe. But to truly understand the results of the referendum, we must look deeper into how voters across the UK ultimately made their decisions. We first visit Hull, a small town that lies on the muddy banks of the River Humber in northern England. For years, the city has been a hub for ships and ferries travelling back and forth to mainland Europe. And so it has earned itself the nickname of the Gateway to Europe. Long past the referendum, the flag of the EU still flies high at the port of this town, even higher than the flag of the United Kingdom. Ironically, the people of Hull voted overwhelmingly in favour of leaving the EU, with a 68% majority. For this long-neglected city, which is home to some of the poorest and most deprived communities across the UK, the referendum demonstrated that the people thought things can't get much worse here.
A place like Hull, I mean, despite being the city of culture and so on, is essentially a predominantly working class, old industrial port city. And it's classic territory for the people who feel left behind by globalization. And I think a lot of this, a lot of the referendum was to do partly with, you know, immigration, but partly of this feeling that people had lost their economic power.
The people of Hull are just as likely to blame the politicians of Westminster as the faceless bureaucrats in Brussels. For them, all such politicians have been distanced from and not concerned about their issues. Tarek Haddad is a journalist at Hull Daily Mail. His observation of the referendum convinced him that there was much more to the way people voted than just the UK's EU membership.
Even if voting to leave had a lot of uncertainty and it might have actually, some people knew it might even make things worse, but for them they just knew that at least it's going to be some sort of change. And I think for a lot of people here that they just need a change. They've had, and things can't really get much worse for a lot of people here.
The benefits of EU membership were ones that they can't really see. You know, even though I believe they're there, they can't really see them. But they can see lots of reasons why a change is welcome, even if they don't know what the change is going to be. Something to sort of lift us out of this, this not very successful period that they feel they're going through. And I think that drove a lot of those working class places such as Hull.
You know, people were led to believe that things are going to get better and, you know, they're going to matter again, we're going to make Britain great again. But I think, to be honest, the vote's happened and now it's just gone back to normal and it's kind of almost sort of business as normal and nothing's really changed for the people of Hull. It's just the same, and I'm surprised actually how they've just accepted it. If I was told that things are going to be great and then everything stayed the same, I'd probably be a bit angrier.
Just 50 miles to the west of Hull lies the historic capital of Yorkshire, one of the few towns in England which opted to remain in the EU. Known to be a much more cosmopolitan city compared to Hull, York enjoys hosting thousands of tourists every year. So the people here are somewhat used to the good side of foreigners.
These cosmopolitan middle-class cities, most of them voted to remain in the EU. And so, you know, a lot of the attitude you would get in a place like York would not be different, very different to the attitude you get in London. You know, whereas Hull is miles different, you know, it's a different country almost. So it didn't surprise me that York voted to remain. I would have thought that was classic Remain territory.
In the busy town centre of York, a young shopkeeper working in a skateboard store tells us why he thinks Britain has made the wrong choice.
Everyone should be open to people wanting to come into this country and like work and experience it. Vice versa, if you want to, like, I want to go travelling soon. Like, I want the thought of people being judgmental towards me wanting to go travel and work in different in Europe.
Originally from the much more conservative town of Grimsby, Will had sensed from early on that the prospects of Brexit was much more likely than the numbers on the polls were showing.
Where I come from is a bit of a backwards little town, and people are very opinionated, and I kind of knew the demographic of who would be voting and what they'd be choosing. A lot of the older generation, I think, will tend to want to vote out, just from the stigma when they was younger against people coming into our country, I guess.
Not all the younger voters were in favour of remaining part of the EU. Callum, a recent graduate working in an ice cream van in the centre of York, was amongst the few people of his age to vote leave. And he had reasons for it.
I voted leave, I guess, for a couple of reasons. The first is, I guess a case of national sovereignty. I feel like my politicians will often hold the EU as the main villain behind the reason why change can't be enacted, in my opinion, whether that's correct or not. And then I think the second one is, it kind of feels like a lie. I don't know. Like, free trade is apparently vitally important, and with that comes the free movement of labour, and I don't know. I feel, rightly or wrongly, it's been very damaging, and, you know, people feel like their living standards have got worse and they've been unable to kind of, like, change it. From what I understand, my government, like, asked for a referendum to be introduced and then only planned for one side, which was the status quo, which is mind-blowing. So, in that sense, yes, it's probably fair that he resigned.
The British people have voted to leave the European Union.
The story of how the referendum came to happen was, in fact, a rather unusual one. Normally, governments would hold a referendum to persuade the public to back a change that they want to introduce. But to initiate a referendum and then start campaigning in favour of the status quo, well, that's something more or less unheard of. But why did David Cameron follow this rather unusual scenario?
It's partly to do with David Cameron's own view of the world. I think there is no doubt that when he first became Prime Minister in 2010, he was pretty deeply sceptical about Europe. He certainly found it a very frustrating institution. He did tend to feel it regulated too much. But on the other hand, he also accepted that, you know, actually being part of a free trade area was to the UK's benefit. And I think the truth is that during the course of his premiership, he became rather more convinced of the merits of the European Union.
David Cameron's personal journey through time wasn't the only thing that sparked the idea of a referendum. During the course of 2012, the United Kingdom Independence Party, known as UKIP, who are known for their anti-Europe and anti-immigrant ideas, began to make electoral progress.
This is a British passport. And what are the first two words on it? European Union.
The success of UKIP appeared to be more of a threat to Cameron's Conservative Party than their fierce rivals across the Parliament.
So he promises in a speech in January 2013, I will hold a referendum on Europe if in the next general election due in 2015, I get an overall majority. Now at that stage, he was the premier of a coalition government with the Liberal Democrats, and the Liberal Democrats historically have been the most pro-European party in the United Kingdom, and certainly the Liberal Democrats made it perfectly clear that they were not willing to allow the then coalition that they were part of to implement any legislation to clear the way for a referendum. And the truth is, we very strongly suspect that David Cameron reckoned he probably would not get an overall majority in 2015. He would hope to be continue to be premier, but probably his best chance was that there'll be another coalition with Democrats, who would summarily say, I'm terribly sorry, but that promise is one you're not going to be able to keep. However, in May 2015, somewhat surprisingly, the Conservatives narrowly won an overall majority, and David Cameron was stuck with the pledge that he had made. He then moved quite rapidly to try to fill that pledge, going pretty rapidly into renegotiations with the European Union, which is what his party pledge was being. He said, I'll renegotiate our terms of membership, and I will then put the issue to the public. The trick didn't work, but David Cameron was committed to a fast renegotiation, didn't really get what he wanted, moved to a very quick referendum. He wanted to get it out of the way, but in the end, he hadn't prepared the ground sufficiently to ensure that he'd won.
Soon after the 2015 general elections, two campaigns came into life, each advocating one side of the argument on Europe. The Remainers.
A Tory Brexit negotiation would be a disaster.
And the Leavers.
Can we go forward to victory on June the 23rd? Yeah! Yes, we can!
The advocates of remaining in the EU campaigned behind the banner of Stronger in Europe.
There was a group of us in the beginning who all sat around looking at what people thought about the EU and testing lots of different names and lots of different messages. So Andrew Cooper from Populous was our main pollster and did a huge amount of research. And looking at the names and the words that people associated with the EU, strength and being stronger was something that people did associate with Europe and that we wanted to keep reinforcing. So it made sense for that to be part of the name.
It was the biggest cross-party campaign ever to be formed in the UK. Old foes came together from the majority of political parties to argue why Britain is better off in the EU.
If we were to vote to leave, all those problems become significantly worse.
But gathering all such high-profile politicians on their side turned out to be somewhat of a disadvantage for the Remainers.
I think on the one hand, it's good to demonstrate that you have cross-party support, that politicians of all different kinds are putting their differences to one side and coming together to argue for this thing. So it must be important. But on the other hand, the Leave campaigns made people think that the establishment and politicians weren't to be trusted, or experts. So while we're busy building a campaign with politicians, economists, historians, scientists, farmers, you name it, all these people saying that we're better off for all these reasons, actually the Leave campaign sort of flipped it the other way around and said, we don't need to listen to experts, it's about you. So in a way, one of our greatest strengths and that diversity of voices arguably turned into a weakness. This was the opportunity to kick the government, to kick the establishment and to be listened to.
The government used whatever was in its power to show why it was important to remain part of the EU, and what disaster would follow if they left. At times, the scaremongering went so extreme that it was hard to be taken seriously.
If we vote to leave on the 23rd of June, we will be voting for higher prices. We will be voting for fewer jobs.
What they did in the case of the EU referendum, and I think it was a mistake, was that the Remain side did Project Fear on steroids. And I think the moment came, and I got a lot of correspondence about this, and a lot of people ring me up. The moment came when, just before the referendum, George Osborne, the then Chancellor, said that if there is a vote to leave, then there will have to be what he describes as a punishment budget. You know, we'll have to increase taxes and cut public spending to keep the public finances on an even keel. And I think that was the point where people just stopped believing it, I think. It sounded too implausible. I mean, the one, you know, if your economy has been hit by a shock, the one thing you don't do is put up taxes and cut public spending. So I think he was responsible, and the government, the Remain side, was responsible for just doing too much of that. And in the end, I think it swung people to the Leave side rather than kept them on the Remain side.
On the other side of the spectrum was a coalition of Eurosceptics, including the leader of the UK Independence Party, Nigel Farage, the former Conservative Mayor of London, Boris Johnson, and some other notable Conservative politicians. Their message was to take back control from the EU.
Take back control of this country. Can you hear me at the back?
Yeah!
Because they managed to encapsulate all of their argument in this phrase, take back control. And that allowed every problem anybody had in their life, whether they didn't like their job, they couldn't get a job, they didn't like the government, they thought public services were under pressure. It's fine. Vote Leave, take back control. Stick everything in the take back control bin.
It was a way of psychologically summing up or addressing in part the sense of uncertainty about the world in which people are living, and also appealing to their sense of, you know, the way in which they feel their sense of identity, their sovereignty, their sense of Britishness was compromised. It brought those things together. It provided a very convenient strapline that, in a sense, encapsulated the underlying psychological argument in a few words. And, of course, that's what any political campaign is always looking for. A few words that tells this message that everybody can pick up and can understand.
One of the senior Conservative politicians who refused to side with the leaders of his own party was Graham Brady. He argued that the British people never got used to integrating into Europe.
There has always been a desire in the United Kingdom for a relationship with Europe which is based on trade and close friendly cooperation. And the European Union was developing increasingly into a federal structure with its own currency, potentially its own military forces, and that level of integration is something that was never right for the United Kingdom. So I think the tensions were constantly building, and at some point were going to have to be resolved.
For most people in the UK, Europe is still something that's other rather than part of us. And British Social Attitudes has regularly ask people, look, here's a list of identities, all the identities that are commonly associated with the islands of Great Britain and Ireland, and typically and consistently only around 15% of people even chose European as one of their identities. Certainly very few people convinced about the idea of the European Union as an ideal that they would want to argue for irrespective of the United Kingdom's own particular interests.
One British industry that perhaps struggled to see the positive side of integration into Europe was the fishing industry. Fishing has been embedded into British life and popular culture for centuries. But the hard-working fishermen across the UK were fed up with restrictions and laws that were unfavourably imposed on them by Europe, including the Common Fisheries Policy that assigns fishing quotas to each member state. To understand the pattern of votes by the fishermen, we speak to Barry Dees, Chief Executive of the UK's National Federation of Fishermen's Organisations.
I would guess that most fishermen in the United Kingdom voted to leave because the Common Fisheries Policy has been, especially in the early days, very unsuccessful, spectacularly unsuccessful actually. And that has left a legacy of mistrust, distrust. At one time, for example, the iconic North Sea cod stocks, our members were obliged to throw away every one fish for each fish that was landed. And that was entirely down to the politics, the regulatory framework that was imposed on us.
Tony Della Hunty is a lobster and crab fisherman from Selsey in the southern port of England.
These are the boats we use to get off.
For years, he has shared his fishing territories in the English Channel with his French and other European counterparts.
We work up to sort of about 6 miles offshore. On the 6 mile line, the French fishermen come in and fish on a regular basis, but also while we're in the EU, our fleet fish out to their territorial waters too. So it's a shared access at the moment. From a fishing industry, it was totally because they see fish on the ground, they're not allowed to catch it, and their foreign counterparts are. The regulation, like the drift net ban, you know, the MSY approach, all the things that are bad about the EU, you know, the fishermen blame the EU for it, and they just want away from it, manage it ourselves. Say, for argument's sake, we had 100 tonnes of fish, and once that 100 tonnes of fish is gone, you have to tie the boat up, you're not allowed to go to sea again. The young fishermen and the older fishermen all wanted out. I don't think there was any difference at all in that. Very strong feelings in the southeast because the smaller inshore fleet feel that they've actually come out a lot worse with the EU regulations. As a nation, I think it was mixed. I think the younger generation possibly more likely to have voted to stay, and the older generation, my age and older, I think were more towards leaving than staying.
The pattern of votes by different age groups provided some interesting insight into how voters made their decision. More than 60% of people over the age of 65 voted in favour of Brexit, while this figure stood at 25% for those aged 24 or younger. There are many reasons as to why the majority of Leave voters were from amongst the elderly. But the explanations sometimes boil down to simple cultural differences.
Do you think of somebody who's a hotel porter in a seaside, kind of declining seaside resort, such as Margate on the coast of Kent, right? And he's an older person, he's been doing this job for a long time. Now, traditionally what happened in this hotel, I mean, he worked, he knew all the cleaning staff. He knew all the waiting staff, and you know, they would get together in the communal area at coffee time or whatever, and they'd be able to talk about the television programmes they'd been watching, etc., etc., what was in the newspaper. There was a common cultural discourse. Well, the hospitality industry is one of the industries above all in the UK which has succeeded in drawing in Eastern European migration. It's now a very common experience, particularly amongst the cleaning staff, that the conversation happens in Polish and not in English. Now think of our older hotel porter. Instead of sharing a common culture with other members of the hotel staff, he no longer understands what they say. They no longer have a common set of cultural references. Meanwhile, bear in mind, he probably hasn't had a pay increase in the last 7 or 8 years, ever since the financial crash. Now in contrast, take your classic young university graduate. I mean, somebody who's read Spanish and economics, right? They've got a job in the city. They work alongside people who've come here from Poland, France, Germany, or wherever. So for this group, you know, young university graduates, globalization means opening up the world. They're comfortable with it. Culturally, this is what they're used to. They actually enjoy living in diverse environments, and they have the labour market skills to cope. So young university graduates, virtually to a man and a woman, voted to remain.
The results of the referendum came as a shock to many, including Nigel Farage himself, who almost conceded the battle hours before the results were announced.
And no, I'm not conceding, but my sense of this is that the government's registration scheme, getting 2 million voters on, the 48-hour extension, may be what tips the balance.
It was as if the Brexit campaigners did not do their homework to prepare for their unlikely win.
You know, I don't think they prepared anything. You know, there was no, you know, the government itself would have carried on as before had we remained in the EU. The Leave side, I mean, many of them are not part of the government, and there was no plan. It was just, if we can achieve this victory, then we'll think about what happens next.
Mr. Johnson, aren't you responsible for implementing Brexit?
Well, that will be up to the next government.
Do you intend to play a part in that next government?
Well, that will be up to the next Prime Minister, but that can't be me.
I got a text message from one of the Leave campaigners saying, I'm scared by the markets. We don't feel like winners. And I think that tells you everything, which is that they didn't think that they were going to win. And that real sense of shock was the case for everybody. And I mean, saying I told you so doesn't help anybody.
Within hours after the results were announced, the country was in turmoil. The markets plunged, the value of the pound slumped to a 31-year low, and with David Cameron offering his resignation, there was no one to lead the country through the difficult times.
My message on breakfast television was that it was critically important that we should have a period of stability and calm and reflection from the government, and that therefore it was critically important that David Cameron should remain Prime Minister. I was saying that live on air as I saw on a television monitor at my feet that the Prime Minister had just resigned.
But I do not think it would be right for me to try to be the captain that steers our country to its next destination.
If you look at measures of consumer confidence, they fell very sharply immediately after the referendum. People were quite worried. You know, you lose a Prime Minister, you lose a Chancellor of the Exchequer, and people think, well, the whole country's sort of falling apart. The surprise for me was that, you know, looking at this from an economic perspective, as I tend to, most elections tend to be what we would call in the jargon pocketbook or wallet elections, that people will vote for what is in their own best interests. And either people in this case didn't believe that there would be an economic downside from leaving the EU, or were prepared to sacrifice some of their income, some of their future income, because they thought this idea of taking back control was more important than that.
In the end, the new Prime Minister to lead Brexit had to be chosen from amongst the strong supporters of Remain. With former London Mayor Boris Johnson backing down, and the veteran Conservative politicians, such as Michael Gove, out of the picture, the then Home Secretary emerged as the sole front-runner.
And can now declare that Mrs May has been elected as the new leader of the Conservative Party with immediate effect.
A politician who only weeks before the referendum had warned of dire economic consequences if UK was to leave Europe. In a secret meeting at Goldman Sachs, just weeks before the referendum, she was heard saying, I think the economic arguments are clear. One of the reasons people invest in the UK is because it is in Europe. And if we are not in Europe, I think there would be firms and companies who would be looking to say, do they need to develop a mainland Europe presence rather than a UK presence? So I think there are definite benefits for us in economic terms.
The problem we have in this country is that whilst the people have spoken, the same players have just been shuffled around the chessboard. And we're still being run by the career professional political class.
For ordinary UK households, Brexit has so far presented them with an uphill economic struggle. With the pound value tumbling by as much as 18%, cost of the dollar or euro-priced goods imported from the UK's biggest trading partners, such as United States and Germany, have risen sharply.
Now, you see that most at its extreme when you look at the costs for industry. So the costs for industry are currently rising at a rate of about 15% a year. And not all of that 15% gets passed on to shop prices, but some of it does. And you move from, you know, having had no inflation in 2015 to maybe having 3 or 4% inflation at some stage over the next couple of years. The number to bear in mind there is that wages, earnings are rising by around about 2%. So, you know, you could get a situation, we will get a situation where prices are rising much more rapidly than people's incomes.
Undoubtedly, some of the biggest victims of Brexit have been the migrant communities. Prior to the referendum, the Leave campaign had focused much of their efforts on how the country was at a breaking point with regards to immigration. And arguably, it was this fear of immigrants that shaped the outcome of the referendum.
It's probably true that but for the relatively high levels of inward migration that the UK has experienced over the last 10 or 15 years, we would have not have voted to leave the European Union. At the end of the day, the crucial political success of UKIP, the party that's principally originally campaigning for leaving, was to link the idea of European Union membership to the level of immigration.
Of course, within the single market, it isn't possible to control EU migration. And this was the fundamental stumbling block that David Cameron encountered in his attempts to negotiate a better deal before the referendum. Had there been some flexibility on that issue of freedom of movement within the single market, then perhaps the referendum would have had a different outcome.
The argument goes as far back as a crucial decision in 2004, when the then Labour government opened up UK borders to Eastern European migrants. Originally, it was thought that 13,000 European citizens would head to the UK in search of jobs and financial benefits every year. In 2015, this figure came close to 250,000.
The United Kingdom, for most of its post-war history, despite the fact that it had experienced quite a lot of inward migration from the Commonwealth in the 60s and 70s, was a net exporter of population. More people from the UK found jobs abroad than came here. Not surprising, economically, for much of the post-war period, we were not that successful. But for the last 10 or 15 years, the UK actually has experienced more inward migration than it has done any period since the flight of the Huguenots in the 17th century. So that inevitably, all experiences of relatively high immigration in virtually any society creates tensions, it creates issues.
Immigration, however, has been extremely important in filling up gaps within the UK labour market. There are particular sectors in the UK that are heavily dependent on EU migrants. In manufacturing, 10% of the total workforce come from Europe. 8% of those in retail, restaurants and hotels are EU workers. And in finance, this figure stands at 7%. Above all, the highest number of EU workers are found in the building and services sector, which continue to be a huge part of the UK economy. It will be a massive challenge to replace such a large section of the UK workforce once Britain closes its borders to Europe.
People, again, have the wrong idea about this. They think it's the jobs that British people don't want to do, but it's often the jobs that British people can't do. You know, there are skill shortages in quite a lot of sectors, in industry, in the building sector, for example, is a good example of that, where we just haven't trained enough people, enough domestic people over many years. So a lot of these industries are quite worried about what will happen when the EU migrants stop arriving, and they've been responsible for a significant proportion of the employment growth that we've had in recent years. They filled gaps in the labour markets, and the loss of them, I think, will lead to quite extreme skill shortages.
I think it's very difficult to run this country without immigration, because they've said at the top end they're not going to restrict it. So talented people who are well qualified, there seems to be no debate that those people should be allowed. I think at the lower end, for many industries, as I say, it's difficult to run the food processing, for example. British people don't have much experience in that industry, and there are many other industries like that. And in some of these industries, if there isn't immigration, then the industries will move to where they can hire workers.
A prime example of how Brexit has led to shortage of staff is the UK's National Health Service, known as the NHS. The UK's hospitals have already been described by the British Red Cross as being in a humanitarian crisis. And Brexit has only been adding to the problems.
The definition of a humanitarian crisis is about a crisis affecting a large number of people for a long period of time. And that's what we are seeing in the health and social care system at the moment.
Dr. Rachel Marangozov is a senior research fellow at the Institute for Employment Studies. Her research has shown that Brexit, along with other factors, will leave some NHS trusts short of nurses.
The key thing to mention about the NHS is that it's already struggling. Take Brexit out of the picture. It's already struggling financially. There are increased demands for its services. We have an ageing population, which is going to place much greater pressure on NHS services and provision. So Brexit will only complicate matters. And I think Brexit really couldn't have come at a worse time for the NHS, given that context. We're not training enough domestic nurses to fill those gaps. So take all of that combined, the nursing workforce is already under pressure and is already experiencing shortages, which has meant that the workforce is particularly vulnerable to any post-Brexit shocks to the system. So if there is any squeeze on the recruitment channels from the EU, that will place greater strain on the NHS. NHS trusts will struggle to recruit from EU countries, and there'll be an increasing number of nursing vacancies.
Stella Toonan came to the UK as a student. Like many other Europeans living in the UK, Stella was shocked at the results of the referendum.
I do feel slightly unwanted now, so I've definitely kind of... Yeah, it's been frustrating to feel that we're not as welcome as I thought I was. It's a weird atmosphere to know that people have voted against having you here as a person, and that's a bit strange.
Originally from Holland, Stella had a difficult time explaining to her family back home why Britain would choose to leave the EU.
I'm all for democracy, clearly, and I think a referendum is a very good way to give people more of a say in what needs to happen. But the point of democracy is also to vote for someone who is an expert in politics to then make the decisions for you, because they've been in politics for ages and they know exactly what's happening, so they can make a better informed decision. And I think with a referendum, you're kind of cutting out that middleman, so you give people a direct say in what should happen, even though they're not experts, clearly. What we've actually done with this referendum is to, instead of give power to the people, we gave power to the media. And I think that's why a lot of people voted Brexit, just because they read newspapers, they read articles, but they mainly read the headlines, and they always heard the short sound bites, the things that are the short bits that were always taken out of the context and didn't have the right nuance. So I think a lot of people voted Brexit just because that's what the media seemed to tell them, and not because they made an informed decision.
For EU students and academics like Stella, the process of exiting the European Union has posed many uncertainties and complications.
The government has not yet been clear as to what will happen, what are the terms and conditions that EU students will have, post 2017. This is even before Brexit actually materializes. This is, of course, the university's minister, Joe Johnson, has been clear that it's part of the negotiating aspect of the whole Brexit, so that they're using EU students as a bargaining tool to see what better deal they could get. So this has created a lot of uncertainty.
The uncertainties are not just limited to academics, but the UK universities are also feeling the heat of Brexit.
The universities fear that they would no longer have a stream of money coming from EU students, which is quite significant in the funding of universities, and also they worry that they may not be able to recruit top talent. If I'm a top academic at Germany and I'm going to have to go through a lot of hoops and bureaucracy to get to the UK, I might decide to go elsewhere. I might even decide, if I'm having to go through the same bureaucracy, I might as well go to the US or to China.
Perhaps one of the most unwelcome impacts of the referendum has been the social implications for the migrants and minorities across the UK. The official figures by the National Police Chiefs Council showed a worrying 58% surge in reported hate crimes following Brexit compared to the previous year. Amongst the prime targets of the racism and hatred unleashed by Brexit were the Polish community.
In the past few days, we've seen despicable graffiti daubed on a Polish community centre.
We haven't managed to clean it all off, so that you can still see the remains of the yellow.
Joanna Majinska is the chairwoman of the Polish Social and Cultural Association in London. On the Sunday immediately after the referendum, xenophobic graffiti was found scrawled across the doors of the centre. One of the many racist incidents against Eastern European migrants that followed Britain's vote to leave the EU.
That obviously shocked people greatly. It was cleaned off quickly so that people wouldn't have to read it as they came into the building on that Sunday. There was people in, I think it was in East Anglia, had cards. There were cards, actually printed out cards saying, "Polish vermin, go home, scum, you go home," you know, put through people's doors and given out to them. Then there was the in Plymouth, where somebody's shed next to their house was set on fire, which could have been, you know, very, very dangerous.
Bro, I'll waste you.
The growing racism was not only limited to the European migrants. The ethnic and religious minorities were also affected.
The leaders of the Brexit campaign have engendered an atmosphere where some people believe it is open season now for racism and xenophobia.
The reality is that this may have unleashed a Pandora's box of bigotry and Islamophobia that has emboldened those who have wanted to say things in the past and haven't felt that they've been able to.
Whitechapel, a densely populated borough in the heart of East London. Home to one of the largest Muslim communities in the UK. Esmat Jeraj is an activist who has worked in the area for many years. She was one of the many Muslims to be a target of racism following Brexit.
It was a Wednesday afternoon as I was walking to work from the station from down there that I had a gentleman walk towards me quite purposefully and tell me to F off out of his country. Now, of course, I was both shocked, angry and very much surprised, as I hadn't faced such blatant racism in a very long time, especially in an area that was so diverse. It was very worrying that such an incident happened in the middle of the day, and with it being so close after the referendum on whether the UK should leave the European Union, it was clear that this was part of a much broader worrying trend around post-referendum racism and xenophobia. Unfortunately, this isn't helped by the way in which the media reports incidences. You'll rarely find a positive news stories about the Muslim community. And in fact, whenever there's something negative, faith is always brought into it if it's a Muslim. Now, of course, this heightens that fear. And in fact, it creates this kind of white noise that often mutes out some of the more logical aspects or the everyday contributions the Muslim can make, and exacerbates this fear and makes people a lot more suspicious of their neighbour who might be Muslim. And I think you've seen this on a daily basis with incidences of Islamophobia, with individuals reporting Muslims who are travelling to authorities for fear that they might be joining Daesh, and just kind of an overall suspicion and distrust of the Muslim community, or more broadly, anyone who doesn't look like them. And I think both politicians and the media have a very strong role to play here in allaying some of these fears with greater religious literacy, but also greater responsible reporting and carefully thinking about the words that they use, rather than just speaking blindly about a community or about a population.
The rising racism and xenophobia has not only been a cause for social concerns, but has also impacted Britain from an economic standpoint. More specifically, in relation to the tourism industry, which is worth a whopping 10% of the UK GDP. After the initial surge in tourism as a direct result of a cheaper pound, figures from the global hotel data firm, STR, showed that the number of empty hotel beds in the capital increased by more than one-third in October 2016 compared to a year earlier.
Racist attacks and, you know, the kind of nastiness that had emerged, they do make people think twice about visiting a place. So I think there was maybe a perception among some potential tourists that, you know, we become less friendly, less welcoming. And if you're coming from the rest of the EU, you know, you've just voted to essentially reject them. And it's not surprising that that changes attitude. So, you know, the pull is that suddenly the UK is very cheap because of what's happened to the pound. But there is this reserve about whether it's such a friendly place to go to. And I think that will affect us over the years. You know, I think the, you know, in time, people will put it behind them. But during the process of exiting, where I think feelings will run quite high, that will have a negative effect on tourism.
Further to causing social divisions across Britain, Brexit also threatened to harm the unity of the United Kingdom. One of the biggest headaches for Theresa May remains to be Scotland, with calls for a second Scottish independence referendum now stronger than ever. Support for Brexit was very low amongst the Scottish people, with 62% of voters choosing to remain part of the European Union. The Scottish National Party sees that as a great indication of why Scotland needs to have its own say on such crucial matters.
Well, I think we don't yet know what Brexit will actually mean. So the government is just beginning the negotiations with the European Union. But we're pretty confident that whatever it is, the United Kingdom will change quite dramatically from what it is today. And therefore, the question that was before people at the last Scottish independence referendum in 2014 has changed dramatically. And as a result, a lot of people have changed their minds. And in a democracy, when people change their minds, they get the chance to have another vote.
One of the people who may change her mind is Chloe Singh from Edinburgh. Chloe voted against Scottish independence in 2014, but she is now considering to choose Europe over the UK.
I was against Brexit, and now I'm unsure if there was a second referendum. I kind of think maybe, yeah, there should be another one, but, and now I'm unsure what I would vote. I would consider the yes side more, I think. Because Brexit was so unexpected, I really did not think it was going to happen. Being part of the European Union, there are a lot of benefits that we have, so I thought, why are we sort of going to segregate ourselves from that? Brexit's going to cause a lot of damage, so I'm thinking maybe Scotland would be better off independent.
The blue colours of the UK flag are fading more strongly than ever. Theresa May's unwillingness to allow Scottish politicians any say on the Brexit process is further encouraging calls for Scottish independence.
It doesn't look very respectful at the minute because people in Scotland voted to remain in the European Union. The Scottish government have tried very hard to find a compromise position which would allow a different expression of opinion in Scotland, would take advantage, take account also of different economic circumstances in Scotland, and they have been met with indifference and contempt by the British government, who refused to talk to the Scottish government. So, you know, that's hardly respect, that's hardly a partnership of equals. And unless something dramatically changes, then I think most people will conclude that we're probably better off trying to take control of our own destiny in the future. In a country the size and diversity of Britain, it's a remarkably arrogant attitude to take, to say, well, one size fits all and whatever London thinks is right, you will have.
1 year on since the EU referendum, Britain will be heading to the polls again, this time to choose a new government.
I have just chaired a meeting of the Cabinet where we agreed that the government should call a general election to be held on the 8th of June.
We welcome the general election, but this is a Prime Minister who promised there wouldn't be one. A Prime Minister who cannot be trusted.
Whatever the outcome of the elections, Britain has a difficult road ahead in its quest to exit Europe. With the Brexit negotiations only beginning, there is still a long way to go to understand whether the British people have made the right choice or not. But what is certain is that, for better or worse, the UK has changed forever. And so has the EU.